I am Plata on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia, at thecommentary.ca. Shooting War is a new book that showcases 18 iconic photographers, starting with their iconic photographs, and then looking at their motivation, their life stories, either with themselves or the people close to them. They are Yanis Barakas, Alexandra Bulat, Corinne Dufka, Lawrence Gay, Ashley Gilbertson, David Gutenfelder, Carol Guzzi, Robin Hammond, Ron Haviv, Tim Hetherington, Santiago Lyon, Peter McGubane, Sir Don McCullen, Tim Page, Charles Porter IV, Sebastio Salgado, Chim Seymour, and Joao Silva. The book's author, Dr. Anthony Feinstein, joins me now. He is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto. He is a Guggenheim Fellow and the winner of a Peabody Award for his documentary, Under Fire, Journalists in Combat. He has published a series of seminal studies exploring the psychological effects of conflict on journalists. This new book is published by Glitterati Editions. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Anthony Feinstein. Dr. Feinstein, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
There are 18 photographers in the book. How did you come to them and the number 18, say?
So I've been researching frontline journalism for the past almost 20 years. I look at how journalists react psychologically to war and conflict and the factors that motivate them to do this kind of work. And over the course of these almost two decades, I have met literally hundreds of wonderful frontline journalists, a percentage of whom are conflict photographers, and through familiarity with their work and collecting their photographs, I have built up, I think, a really large library of war photography. And I thought it would be a good idea to write about some of these photographers, but starting from the perspective of a particular photograph. And so each one of these photographs in the book is a favorite of mine. And while there are obviously a huge number of photographs to choose from, I focus down on those that, from my perspective, have moved me the most, have intrigued me the most, and I work from there.
And so I hate to call them pieces of art, but I mean, they are in one way, but in another, I mean, photographs are very different than, say, paintings. But obviously, a lot of these, all of these images in this book have moved you a great deal, or that you've pondered them, thought about them for a long time.
Yes.
Every time you see them, does the experience of that, does that change?
No, I think every time I see them, I marvel at them once more. They cause me to pause and reflect. I think like many great works, they are timeless. I think they represent so many aspects of conflict. They tell powerful stories. So it's something that one can come back to repeatedly without, I believe, the photograph losing its impact.
And having studied them as you have, not only the photographer, but the context, I guess that adds to the richness every time you look at it, right?
Very much so. In fact, for me, that in many ways is the most intriguing part, because when I started this project, I wanted to get a better understanding of the photographers who have done this work, and it became apparent to me that, you know, impressive as these photographs are and powerful as they are, they also basically obscure an important fact, which is that the photographers who take these photographs pay quite a high price for this work. A very high price for it. And that's the theme that runs throughout my book, is the challenge of this kind of work and the cost that it can take on the photographers.
And as I'm reading the book, the thing that occurred to me as a media consumer, we should think about that when we consume media, and especially when we see the photographs that come from overseas, from a conflict, for example. I mean, there's something that I think a lot of us overlook and that we tend to forget.
I think that's right, very much so. You know, myself included, that when I first, you know, started to do this work, I would look at these photographs and I would marvel at the content, but I never initially thought about what did it take to actually get this image? What did the photographer have to go to obtain such a remarkable photograph? And as I started to explore their lives and get a better understanding of, you know, conflict journalism in general, you know, what becomes quickly apparent to me is that this is very, very hard work. Not just, you know, not just dangerous, but physically taxing, emotionally taxing, and the cost that can be paid by photojournalists is high.
Yeah, you mentioned the physical danger. There's also the moral conflict of it all. When you talk to these 18 photographers, not all of them you got to talk to, because some of them have died, but you talk to their family, you talk to people around them. Do you get a sense as to, I don't know, I mean, they seem different than the rest of us in the sense that they've got different skills. And in terms of the risk-taking itself, are they different in that sense? I mean, do you find that they have something that, say, a lot of people don't have when it comes to taking risk?
Well, you know, the first observation is this, that these are individuals who have spent a prolonged period of their professional lives in very dangerous places, and they do so willingly, by choice. In many ways, they've had a lot more exposure to danger than soldiers. You know, we know that a soldier can have a tour of duty, or maybe two tours of duty, exceptionally maybe three, but these are individuals, these photographers, who've gone back to conflict, you know, decade after decade, and so their cumulative exposure to, you know, the most dangerous places on earth is extraordinary. And I've concluded that in order to sustain a career like this, you have to have a particular kind of personality, a certain kind of biology that has wired you in a certain way. You've got to have a certain psychological makeup that allows you to do this. Because if you didn't, you would not have such a long and storied career in such dangerous places. So, you know, from a behavioral perspective, that's a very interesting group to look at. So you're right. I think if you look at risk taking along a spectrum, you know, these are individuals who are at one far end of the spectrum. But you know, to stress this point, you know, they're not doing it for risk. I mean, the job comes with risk, but I think the motivation behind it is very different from just, you know, exposing myself to something dangerous.
That said, have you found news organizations nowadays doing enough for their journalists in terms of preparing them for what's ahead of them, especially when they have to go to a conflict overseas?
Yes, I certainly think it's starting to change. You know, when I did this work back in the late 1990s and the early 2000s, there was very little, if anything, in place from a psychological perspective to help journalists. But with, you know, as publications have started to explore this aspect of a journalist's life, the good news organizations have begun to realize that this is a very important aspect of keeping a journalist safe. That is not just enough to make sure that they're physically safe. You can't just send a journalist on a hostile environment training course and say we've done everything. There needs to be another component to it, and that's, you know, how can you keep an individual psychologically well, or if they develop, you know, psychological difficulties, how can we help them? So I think there's been a sea change in the attitude of news organizations on this particular question. I think there's still quite a bit more that needs to be done,
mm-hmm.
because unfortunately mental health always lags behind physical health in terms of priorities and resources.
Uh-huh.
But I do believe the good news organizations like the New York Times, CNN, Reuters, in Canada, the Globe and Mail, CBC are now taking this very seriously.
One of the things that you get when you read your book is that all of these photographers, these 18 people, are endowed with such resilience. And I guess I'm wondering, Dr. Feinstein, what's the lesson that you've derived on resilience? I mean, we can learn a lot from these people, and I guess what sustains them would be instructive to the rest of us.
Yeah, isn't that an intriguing question? I agree, and you marvel at it. So let me give you one good example, which I think illustrates you know, your question so well. So João Silva, the South African photojournalist who has a long and storied career as a war photographer, ends up with these grievous injuries in Afghanistan when he stands on a landmine, he loses his limbs, he develops significant abdominal injuries, and the New York Times brings him back through Germany to the United States for prolonged rehabilitation. And I went to visit Zhao when he was in Bethesda at the Walter Reed. He was going in regularly for his treatment. And it was a marvel to see that, you know, while this was clearly a life-altering event for him and a very distressing event for him, he didn't develop PTSD, for example. And it became clear to me as I got to know him a little better and the kind of strategies that he put into place is that, unbeknownst to himself, his coping strategy contained the building blocks of a particular therapy called cognitive behavior therapy. And, you know, to summarize, what that is that you focus on problem solving. If there's a particular difficulty in your way, how might I solve that? What's going to be the solution to it? Or how can I work my way around it? So rather than using avoidance or emotion-based decisions, instinctively some cognitive behavior type techniques kicked in. And so when he was alone at night in his hospital bed or in his apartment, you know, far from his family, his wife and children, far from his parents, going through this, you know, extraordinarily difficult rehabilitation, he would basically come up with an approach that would get him through the next 24 hours, not the next week, not the next year, the next 24 hours in which he would problem solve and work around the challenge of the day. And that proved to be singularly effective, I believe, in, you know, keeping up his emotional resilience.
Yeah. I mean,
the other individuals who might develop PTSD, and I think, you know, I don't want to make a distinction between any journalist or the other journalists who end up with post-traumatic stress disorder, engage in a very effective way with therapists and work to overcome their problem, I think, in a very similar fashion. And so, at the end of the day, whether you end up with a disorder or don't, if you do, you end up seeing a therapist, the outcome is, I think, quite remarkable because, you know, people get better and they get back to doing this kind of work.
A lot of these photographers have to deal with the misery that they've seen long after. How have a lot of them coped in terms of... In terms of how bad it got for them, and I mean, are there any that stick out in mind of these 18?
You know, there is this whole question of moral injury, and a number of journalists. I think Don McCullen is a very good example of that. He's now Sir Don McCullen, and you know, he's a man in his 80s, and he's had a very, very long career as a conflict photographer, and you know, he speaks about how some of these images stay with him. Some of the images in particular from the conflict in Biafra, in Nigeria, you know, the famine that he saw, some of the things that he photographed, those images have lived on with him for many years thereafter and do prove distressing. And you know, he speaks about his guilt at photographing some of these individuals and essentially building a building a career, you know, a storied, celebrated career in many ways as he sees it based on the suffering of other people. And so, you know, he's giving voice to something called moral injury, and I think this guilt is misplaced, but nevertheless it's very real to him and a source of distress. And there's images that come back into his consciousness, you know, act as a source of distress to him and trigger this sense of guilt and moral failure on his part. And so, you know, there's no doubt that the consequences of this kind of work can certainly follow some of these photojournalists around and cause them difficulties. That's not to say that this is necessarily a mental illness. I don't think it is. But it certainly can cause some enduring distress.
And so how does one work through moral injury?
That's really a good question, because I think moral injury is associated with a sense of shame and guilt. Those are the predominant emotions linked to it. And I think one of the challenges of journalists who do this kind of work is that before they go into a particular story or into a conflict zone, they need to have a very clear understanding of why they're there, what they can do, what they can't do, to recognize that while some intervention is perhaps inevitable because they want to can't stand back from another individual suffering. There also needs to be a recognition on their part that their role is predominantly as a journalist, as a chronicler of history, and not as an aid worker, not as a physician. And if the margins to these professions become blurred, then potentially an individual is on a slippery slope towards moral injury.
Mm.
And this was illustrated to me very clearly in a study that I just completed of journalists covering the refugee crisis in Europe, in which, you know, these were journalists who historically had always covered conflict very far from their homes, but now suddenly they were dealing with a story that was right on their doorstep in their own country.
Uh-huh.
And so it had a particular immediacy for them. And for some journalists, that, in a sense, raised the moral temperature. You know, what do you do? This is my country. These are people in my country. I'm a citizen of this country. What is my role? And the margins started to become a little blurred for some journalists in terms of helping. How much help could you give? Where did the help end? If I'm giving money, how much money do I give? Which person do I give the money to? And so they ended up with some really uncomfortable decisions to make. If I help one child, why don't I help another child? Why did I choose that family over another family? And, you know, some of the journalists, you know, with the best of intentions, would give out email addresses to refugees, and suddenly they would be flooded by all sorts of pleas for help, etc. And so it became a very difficult situation for some of these journalists to manage because moral injury had intruded. They felt that somehow, from a moral perspective, they needed to do something other than work as a journalist.
Yeah.
And so there is no easy answer to these questions, but I do think that journalists, and this is very difficult, have to keep a balance and recognize that they are primarily journalists. They're not aid workers. They're not, you know, working for NGOs. Because if you don't follow that very clear direction, then potentially you leave yourself open to some really difficult emotional situations.
And that goes back to the responsibility that we have as news consumers, if you will. I hate to use that term, but I mean that's the only thing I can think of. Because a lot of people will see the work of say a conflict photographer and say, well, you know, why didn't you just put the camera down and help?
Yes.
Because that line is blurred for a lot of people, and so when that happens, I mean, are you compelled then to tell them to remember that there is this line and to maintain that line?
Well, that's such a difficult question to answer, because yes, they all put the cameras down to help. I've not come across a journalist who hasn't, at some point in their long career, done something directly to help a person, whether it's, you know, to give them water, to give them money, to give them food, to give them a ride.
Uh-huh.
In the case of the migrants arriving on the beaches of Europe, sometimes even wading into the water to try and, you know, help somebody who can't swim. So yes, they are doing it, but you know, at the same time, there needs to be a recognition that that there's another task at hand over here, which is to tell the story and to take the photograph. And so there needs to be a balance in terms of what you can do. Often in situations like these, in fact, frequently, the level of misery is so profound and so extensive that no amount of intervention is going to make the situation better. That doesn't mean you don't intervene in a particular situation, but it just means that there needs to be a balance, and you need to have an understanding and an appreciation of what you can do. And think it through before you do it. Think about how you're going to approach such a situation. And indeed, this conversation that we're having now needs to be had between journalists and the newsroom. You know, between journalists, these photojournalists, and the editors. There needs to be an understanding of what does the news organization expect from you. You know, how much should we intervene? What should that intervention be? It's not necessarily, I think it's, you know, not necessarily correct for psychiatrists like myself to prescribe what that is, other than to point out that this is potentially a slippery slope, and there should be a discussion about it, and as much as you can, in advance, get some clarity as to what needs to be done. So I'm very careful of being too prescriptive over here. I think, you know, historically, psychiatry's made many mistakes about telling people what's good for them. I think this particular question needs to be discussed at length within the journalism profession, and the answers that they come to, which might be facilitated by, you know, individuals like myself, but the answers that they should come to should be homegrown answers. They need to sort this out.
Your book reminds us, Dr. Francine, that these are challenging times to be a journalist. And it is important work that they do, despite what, say, other public figures might say in terms of their rhetoric and in politics about the press being the enemy, say.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think the work that these individuals do is of great significance. You know, they keep us in civil society informed of events that we should know about. We need to know what's going on in other parts of the world. We are all interconnected now, you know, through the internet. There is a global community. Events that take place far from Canada can have the most profound effect on us living in Canada. And just think of 9/11 and the origins of 9/11. What would make people want to fly aeroplanes into skyscrapers? You know, what makes an individual want to attack Parliament Hill in Ottawa? We need to understand what's going on in the world, and these individuals who take these photographs fulfill their task. They are visual historians, they're contemporary historians, they keep us in civil society informed. And, you know, without wishing to belabor the point, the message of the book is that it's wonderful that they do that, but this comes at a cost to them.
One of the things I'm wondering about as I finished your book, Shooting War, was the experience for you through writing this book, not to mention your work. You have to deal with the trauma of others. One assumes that you can't not be affected by what you see or hear in the course of your work. How do you deal with that yourself? I mean, does that go home with you at the end of the day, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you do hear very moving stories and very upsetting stories. But, you know, one of the principles of medicine is that, you know, one needs to keep an emotional distance, you know, from someone without losing your empathy. I think empathy is very important. You can't come across as cold and disconnected. But at the same time, you know, I am a behavioral scientist. I'm a researcher. At times, I'm a psychiatrist. And in all of these roles, it's very important to keep this emotional distance, because I think that allows you to do this work. It keeps you objective, which is essential, as much as one can be objective. I think objectivity here is very important. You know, much as I admire these men and women who take these photographs, they're not family members. And so this boundary that separates me from them is very important in allowing me to do this kind of work. I think if you can't keep that boundary, then this work can overwhelm you. And at the same time, you do have to tread this very fine line between, you know, cool objectivity and at the same time being able to show empathy, which I think is essential as well.
There's so much to learn from this book, stuff that we all need, obviously. It's a beautiful book. It's a fine achievement. I found the work that you've done over the years important work, and it's been such an honor to talk to you today. I appreciate your time. Thanks for this.
Well, thank you very much for your interest. I really enjoyed talking to you.
The book is called Shooting War, 18 Profiles of Conflict Photographers. It's published by Glitterati Editions. Its foreword is by Sir Harold Evans, and its author, Dr. Anthony Feinstein, joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planto.